and 150,000 frames per movie. In total, more than 1 million frames for the saga. The time-consuming process started in September 2005 and was completed in 2008. Note, the first edition was published in 2011 in a limited edition of 1,138 copies signed by George Lucas. The books were boxed in an Art Deco-inspired wooden case and cost $3,000. Star Wars and History, edited by Nancy R. Reagan and Janice Little. John Wiley & Sons, 2013, hardback, 332 pages, indexed. Beautifully printed on glossy stock and profusely illustrated, this anthology collects articles by teachers and historians, tying world history together with the Star Wars saga. Leaning more toward the academic than toward pop culture, the book necessarily strikes a balance between the real world and the imaginative world created by Lucas. A little dry textually, though, as it was written by academics. It is especially useful for putting the Star Wars universe into a historical context. Star Wars Art, Illustration, edited by Eric Cluffer, Abrams, 2012, hardback, 175 pages. The third book in the series, this collects art from multiple sources hand-picked by George Lucas. Short bios of each artist are in the back. Star Wars Art, Posters, edited by Eric Cluffer, Abrams, 2014, hardback, 179 pages. The fifth book in the series, this collects art from multiple sources, from every nook and cranny of the Star Wars universe, including fan club exclusives, foreign one-sheets, and limited edition posters from Mondo. The book's foreword is by artist Drew Struzan, who is celebrated for his iconic movie poster art for the saga. Star Wars Imperial Handbook, A Commander's Guide, by Admiral Wulf Yularen. Chronicle Books, LLC, 2015. Hardback, 159 pages, not indexed. This is a packaged book from Becker and Mayer, Bellevue, Washington. A work of pseudo-history, it provides detailed insights into the composition and organization of the Imperial Army, Navy, and Stormtrooper Corps, plus a surprising amount of detail concerning experimental technology and superweapons, as Commander Luke Skywalker, Alliance Command, writes in a memo printed in the book. With an overview of the Imperial military, followed by detailed chapters on its three branches of military service, the book concludes with essays on the Empire's strategic goals, on the rebellion itself, and on superweapons, including the Imperial DS-1 orbital battle station, the Death Star. This is more for the hardcore armchair general and gamers than for the lay reader. Profusely illustrated with black and white and color photos, bulleted lists, and sidebars aplenty, it's essentially an illustrated table of organization and equipment with supplemental material. The write-up on the Empire's field artillery is egregious, or as we redlegs say, a misfire. Note, there are annotations by various rebel officers, including all the usual suspects. Unfortunately, they are in small, handwritten print and difficult to read. Star Wars Rogue One, The Ultimate Visual Guide, by Pablo Hidalgo, with illustrations by Kemp Remillard. DK Publishing, 2016, hardback, 192 pages, an oversized book in full color. One of DK's oversized, exhaustively detailed, and profusely illustrated guidebooks, this one focuses on Rogue One, the first standalone movie billed as a Star Wars story. As with all their books in this series, the writing is detailed and exhaustively so, backed up with numerous photographs and artwork. The emphasis, as the book's title suggests, is on its visual aspects. Star Wars, Ralph McQuarrie, by Brandon Allinger, Wade Legios, and David Mandel, in cooperation with the Ralph McQuarrie Archives, Abrams, 2016, hardback, 2 volumes, Volume 1 is 399 pages plus index. Volume 2 is 399 pages, slipcased. This book belongs on the shelf of every Star Wars fan. A retrospective looking at the sketches, conceptual designs, and finished pieces by artist Ralph McQuarrie, who more than anyone else was responsible for the look and feel of the Star Wars universe, starting with the finished pieces of art that helped sell the first movie to the studio. As Lucas wrote in a foreword to McQuarrie's book, "I needed him to envision the costumes and the demeanor of Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker, Chewbacca, and C-3PO and R2-D2, among others, to create visuals to help us budget the film. These are the books you are looking for. If you only buy one book in this list, this is it." Star Wars Storyboards, the original trilogy, edited by J.W. Rinzler, Abrams, 2014. A storyboard is a sequence of drawings, often including some directions and dialogue, outlining the shots planned for a movie. This book brings together the storyboards for the three original Star Wars movies, Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. More for film fans than for the lay reader whose interest is predominantly watching the finished film, these storyboards give a sense of the flow of the movie, beginning with the dramatic opening of A New Hope, in which a Star Destroyer fills the movie screen in hot pursuit of the Rebel Alliance spaceship Tantive IV. Star Wars Trilogy, Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, OSP Publishing, 1995, second printing, trade paperback, slipcased. Part of the movie script library from Premiere, this set is text only, reprinting the original movie scripts. These are very useful for checking the actual dialogue against the movie if you're a hopeless geek, an obsessive Star Wars fan, or a student, scholar, or pop culture writer. Interestingly, the text and the final filmed version don't necessarily agree. The Star Wars Vault, by Stephen J. Sansweet and Peter Vilmer. HarperCollins, packaged by Becker and Mayer, 2007. Hardback, 126 pages. Sansweet, who was director of content management and head of fan relations at Lucasfilm, has the largest collection of Star Wars material in private hands. The collection is the centerpiece of his company, Rancho Obi-Wan, Inc. In other words, he's the best person to edit/compile a scrapbook reproducing Star Wars memorabilia. It's billed as 30 years of treasures from the Lucasfilm archives with removable memorabilia and two audio CDs. Great fun. This is a trip through the Star Wars universe, 1977 to 2007, with all sorts of interesting facsimile items. Star Wars Visions by J.W. Rinzler, Abrams, 2010, trade hardback, 175 pages. This is an unusual book in that it's not a recapitulation, textually or visually, of the known Star Wars universe. Instead, it is, as George Lucas states in the foreword, a compilation of newly commissioned artwork. As Star Wars began to take on a life of its own, it was especially gratifying to see so many new artists expand on the saga through our licensing program and elsewhere. And that led to the thought that was really the impetus for this project, asking a select group of great contemporary artists of many different genres and styles to create interpretations of Star Wars. Consequently, we get, for instance, a portrait of Lucas in the cantina scene at Mos Eisley, and one of Darth Vader with drawn lightsaber held upright, standing behind a blonde beauty who has a stormtrooper helmet in hand, midriff exposed, and torso body armor with shapely breasts. The late Carrie Fisher once observed that there's no sex in Star Wars. Well, there is now. Star Wars Year by Year, A Visual History, Updated and Expanded. DK Publishing, 2016, hardback, 367 pages. Looking at the entire franchise, the emphasis is on the pop culture aspects of the series with contextual real-world material, a printed time capsule. For instance, April and July 1976 have entries about the first Apple computer, $666.66, and the Entebbe rescue by the Israel Defense Forces, along with entries showing scenes from Tatooine and a slide of Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia shown at a presentation at a science fiction convention, WesterCon, in California. Ultimate Star Wars by Patricia Barr, Adam Bray, Daniel Wallace, and Ryder Windham. DK Publishing, 2015, trade hardback, 319 pages. A single volume collecting detailed write-ups and photos/art for characters, creatures, locations, technology, and vehicles. Unofficial books about George Lucas and Star Wars. George Lucas, A Life, by Brian J. Jones, Little Brown and Company, 2016, hardback, 560 pages. Though this book is unauthorized with no access to Lucas, Lucasfilm, or affiliated companies, Jones serves up the most complete and up-to-date narrative of Lucas's life and times, which makes this book the biography of choice. This is the book you're looking for. How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, The Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion Dollar Franchise by Chris Taylor. Basic Books, 2014. Hardback, 450 pages. An overview of the Star Wars phenomenon with particular attention paid to the early years leading up to the first film. As the author points out, before Star Wars, no one had ever made a dime out of toy merchandising associated with a movie. In 1978, the company sold more than 42 million Star Wars items. The majority, 26 million, were action figures. More than $20 billion of merchandising has been sold over the lifetime of the franchise. The Princess Diarist by Carrie Fisher. Blue Rider Press, 2016. Hardback, 257 pages. Illustrated with candid black and white photos. From the late, great Carrie Fisher, who had a second career as a writer and scriptwriter/script doctor, this is an unvarnished look at her time as Princess Leia, culled from Fisher's diaries of the period when she was filming the original Star Wars movie in 1977. Yes, she had an affair with Harrison Ford, but did we really need to know that? Too much information. The Science of Star Wars by Jean Cavellos, St. Martin's, 1999, hardback, 255 pages, not illustrated. From the author of The Science of the X-Files, 1998, this is a sober look at the actual science in Star Wars, what's possible, what's improbable, and what's impossible. Organized thematically, planetary environments, aliens, droids, spaceships and weapons, and the Force, its author, an astrophysicist, does a fine job of explaining that, although the movie is clearly a space fantasy, it's rooted in science fiction, in its extrapolation of what we have today and what we might see in the future. In other words, it's not fantasy, and it's not just speculation. It's extrapolation grounded in the science of today. Catnip for science geeks. The Science of Star Wars by Mark Brake and John Chase. Racehorse Publishing, 2016, trade paperback, 261 pages, not illustrated. These guys have the credentials to write this book, and they do so in entertaining fashion. It obviously duplicates some of the ground in Cavellos' book, but it's still a hoot and a half, as Dr. Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang Theory would say. Skywalking, The Life and Films of George Lucas, updated edition, by Dale Pollack. DiCapo, 1999, trade paperback, 332 pages, illustrated with two black and white photo inserts. The original edition was published in 1983. This edition includes one additional chapter tacked on the end. Though this book was unauthorized, as the author acknowledges, he had the cooperation of George Lucas. Once granted, his cooperation was total, his access unlimited, and his interest unflagging. Lucas's close associates matched his commitment to this project. Though it is outdated, this biography obviously benefits from the author's access to Lucas, who gave him an unprecedented 70 hours of interviews, in addition to interviews with 100 other people who were central to Lucas's life. As Pollack told the Washington Post, May 19, 2005, Lucas hated it because it's honest, doesn't pull any punches, and was well-researched, that is, does not rely on only George's version of life and the universe. I think it was upsetting to him to actually read what he said about people. I was surprised by the vehemence of his reaction because to me, 21 years later, the book is a very balanced portrait. I agree with Pollack's assessment. For Star Wars fans, it's valuable because of the exclusive interviews Lucas granted. Taken as a whole, the book is good and has held up well over the years. I don't imagine Lucas will sit for an authorized book again anytime soon unless he has complete editorial control. I also don't imagine he'll write an autobiography because he dislikes writing. Military Books of Interest. The Star Wars canon is exhaustively cataloged in numerous books, giving verisimilitude to its expanded universe. It's entertaining, but it's pseudo-history. It's fiction. To give those books context, we must look at military history over the centuries. On the assumption that the reader of this book has not served in the military, here's my recommended list of books, mostly contemporary, that will give you a real-world look at the U.S. military. Footnote, my library of 20,000-plus books contains hundreds of books about military history, many about World War II, so my choices are not gleaned from brief write-ups of books online, but from texts, many of which are out of print, that I've culled over many years. End footnote. The 1st Infantry Division and the U.S. Army Transformed by Gregory Fontenot. A long time ago, a great adventure had to take place. The U.S. Army had to reinvent itself. Demoralized and broken after the Vietnam War, the Big Red One, the 1st Infantry Division, had to transform itself in order to restore itself to its former glory. Spanning three decades, 1970 to 1991, this book, written by retired Colonel Fontenot, who served in the 1st ID, takes a long, studied look at how this heavy division became great again, notably showing its true colors during Desert Storm. Highly recommended, with a ground-level view of the war that toppled the late Saddam Hussein from power, this book is an insider's view on how a unit can transform itself when its leaders decide to take charge, set high standards, and push their troops toward excellence. About Face: The Odyssey of an American Warrior by David H. Hackworth and Julie Sherman. I love the ironic title. He was like that. The late Colonel Hackworth was unquestionably an army warrior who earned his pair of eagles, the insignia of a full colonel. He later became the Army's harshest critic, distancing himself philosophically from the Pentagon's perfumed princes, as he termed them. On the fast track to become a general, he refused that path. An outspoken critic of the Vietnam War, he gave an interview to ABC on June 27, 1971, sharing his view that the war was unwinnable and that it was high time for the country to get the hell out of it. As the New York Times pointed out in his obituary, May 6, 2005, he enraged his superiors by lambasting the war on national television. After retiring, Hackworth made a permanent move to Australia. The autobiography is, as you'd expect, frank and brutally honest, which was his style. For those especially interested in the Vietnam War, this book is required reading. His website is hackworth.com. My American Journey by Colin Powell with Joseph E. Persico. General Powell was commissioned through the ROTC program, and his autobiography gives a detailed account of his life and times, with the result that you get a clear idea of what it's like to spend a lifetime serving on active duty in the Army, and as a result, learn a lot about leadership, what works and what doesn't. A former Secretary of State, Powell was also chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff overseeing the Iraq War. See entry on General H. Norman Schwarzkopf. He has no website, but he does have a Facebook page, facebook.com/Jen Powell. The Art of War by Sun Tzu. The classic book on military strategy, as relevant today as it was when it was written. Read it, study it, cherish it. The Atlas of Military History, an around-the-world survey of warfare through the ages by Amanda Lomazoff with Aaron Ralby. A coffee table book, 11 by 14 inches, with extensive use of historical photos and maps. Major conflicts are covered by geographic region. Black Hawk Down, A Story of Modern War by Mark Bowden. This is the book that popularized the narrative nonfiction field of military books, with a you-are-there perspective on what went down, like the eponymous Black Hawk on October 1993 in Mogadishu, Somalia. This is the harrowing, true tale of U.S. Rangers downed in a hostile city. We can never forget the color photos taken by Canadian photographer Paul Watson showing a U.S. Army Staff Sergeant, William Cleveland, being dragged naked through the streets of Mogadishu as supporters of warlord Mohammed Aidid celebrated and lustily cheered at the spectacle. This is what war really looks like up close and personal. It doesn't get any uglier and brutal than this. Common Sense Training, A Working Philosophy for Leaders by Lieutenant General Arthur S. Collins, Jr. Over the years, I've worn out several copies of this trade paperback with handwritten notes, underlining, and other emendations. It was my constant companion as a young lieutenant, and I carried it with me on every field exercise. When there was a free moment, I read it and reread it. Collins' Practical Guide to Small Unit Training in the Army, published in 1978, offers time-tested and timeless advice that is still pertinent today. The original edition is long out of print, but its refreshed edition has been amended by Lieutenant General Daniel P. Bolger, author of Why We Lost, see entry below. As the publisher points out, this book was reissued without change to the main text, because in the 20 years since it was first published in 1978, it has become a genuine classic, more widely read than any other book like it. It's especially useful for battalion commanders and below who are the principal trainers in the Army. As Army Magazine said, this is the best book on military training from platoon to division level that has been published in any Army. I agree. Dereliction of Duty by H.R. McMaster. A scathing denunciation of the leadership's conduct of the Vietnam War, McMaster, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy who rose to the rank of Lieutenant General, is currently serving as the 26th National Security Advisor under President Donald Trump. The title says it all. The subtitle names the perps: President Lyndon Johnson, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who stood mute as they knowingly extended an unwinnable war, regardless of the cost in blood and money. Too cowardly to stand up, they refused to screw their courage to the sticking place, take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. In other words, they were derelict in their duties, and as a result, the war was needlessly prolonged and too many young Americans paid the ultimate price. Written when McMaster was a major, the book became required reading in military circles, especially the Pentagon. It should also be read by every high-level official in the U.S. government. Dispatches by Michael Herr. A nonfiction account of the Vietnam War as seen through the eyes of grunts, this paints a surreal and haunting picture of a war that seemed to never end. More than any other book, this captures the hallucinogenic flavor of the war written in the vernacular of the grunts who fought it. To heighten your reading mood, read it with 60s rock and roll music playing in the background. A History of War in 100 Battles by Richard Overy. Organized thematically, leadership, innovation, deception, courage in the face of fire, in the nick of time, this is principally text with some photos for illustration. It draws on 3,000 years of military history, dissecting what the author considers to be the battles that define warfare. It doesn't take a hero. The autobiography of General H. Norman Schwarzkopf, with Peter Petrie. A 4-star general who graduated from West Point and went on to command the Allied forces in the Gulf War, H. Norman Schwarzkopf reported to another 4-star general, Colin Powell. The late General Schwarzkopf was tapped to be the next U.S. Army Chief of Staff, but declined, choosing to retire instead of overseeing the inevitable drawdown of the U.S. Army that he so loved and to which he devoted his life. The book covers his military career from his days at West Point to the Gulf War. Stormin Norman, also nicknamed the Bear, was gruff and tough, and an inspirational warrior whose presence projected confidence and authority. An outspoken officer who doesn't pull punches in this book, he's especially critical of incompetent officers whom he felt should never have risen to high rank. Schwarzkopf's book title is drawn from a television interview from 1991 in which he told Barbara Walters, "It doesn't take a hero to order men into combat. It takes a hero to be one of those men who goes into battle." Military History, The Definitive Visual Guide to the Objects of War. Chronologically arranged, this is the history of warfare as seen through the weapons of war. Profusely illustrated, which is a hallmark of DK Publishing, this book makes history come alive in a way that text-only books cannot. No Easy Day, The First-Hand Account of the Mission That Killed Osama Bin Laden, by Mark Owen, with Kevin Maurer. Drawing its title from a Navy SEAL motto, "The only easy day was yesterday," this memoir, a blow-by-blow recounting of the mission to capture or kill Osama bin Laden on his home turf, is a riveting read. In the closed community of SEAL team members, the explosion of books penned by former SEALs is controversial because of their traditional code of silence. That these books have gone on to make their authors big bucks is also offensive to the SEAL team community because it's cashing in when what they do is not about money. It's about duty, honor, country. Moreover, the public appetite for information by and about SEALs has resulted, some say, in too much revelation about the inner workings of the SEALs, especially its elite SEAL Team 6. No Excuse Leadership, Lessons from the U.S. Army's Elite Rangers, by Brace E. Barber. A West Point graduate and former Airborne Ranger with 11 years in service, Barber explains why Rangers lead the way. The chapters are organized by attributes. Rangers are persistent, humble, focused, driven, instinctual, honest, selfless, confident, dutiful, determined. An insider's look at the Rangers' world that is as useful for military personnel as it is for leaders in the business community. Small Unit Leadership, A Common Sense Approach, by Colonel Dandridge M. Malone, U.S. Army retired, a complimentary book to Common Sense Training. Why We Lost, A General's Inside Account of the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars, by Daniel P. Bolger. A retired lieutenant general who speaks frankly and bluntly, Bolger opens the book with an author's note that begins, "I am a United States Army general, and I lost the global war on terrorism. Well, I have a problem. So do my peers. And thanks to our problem, now all of America has a problem, to wit, two lost campaigns and a war gone awry." Makes you wish he had been around during the Vietnam War, because he would have stood up against the Secretary of Defense and the President and spoken his mind when the other generals stood mute. A sobering read and a reminder that our leaders should go to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall and look at the names of the fallen etched on the black granite memorial and then think long and hard before sending troops to a war zone. Tom Clancy. For an overview of the U.S. military written in consultation with high-ranking officers, the late Tom Clancy's nonfiction books, though outdated and in need of refreshing, are entertaining and educational. Had Clancy been a military officer, he would have made an excellent intelligence officer in the Army or Navy. He was a lifelong student of military history, always analyzing the world of the warrior. It was his passion. He's best known and celebrated for his first book, The Hunt for Red October, which was published by Naval Institute Press in 1984. President Reagan read it, loved it, and said it was my kind of yarn. It's his best book, and like an ICBM, it launched his career. Clancy's nonfiction books include Battle Ready, with Marine General Tony Zinni, Shadow Warriors, Inside the Special Forces, Submarine, A Guided Tour Inside a Nuclear Warship, Carrier, A Guided Tour of an Aircraft Commander, Every Man a Tiger, The Gulf War Air Campaign, with Air Force General Chuck Horner, Airborne, A Guided Tour of an Airborne Task Force, Into the Storm, On the Ground in Iraq, with Army General Frederick M. Franks, Jr., Marine, A Guided Tour of a Marine Expeditionary Unit, Fighter Wing, A Guided Tour of an Air Force Combat Wing, and Armored Cav, A Guided Tour of an Armored Cavalry Regiment. Miscellaneous Star Wars Resources. Products. Even before George Lucas sold Star Wars to the Walt Disney Company, he saw the value of licensing as a means of ongoing revenue and as a promotional vehicle. The result, even back then, was a tsunami of product, with something for everyone from children to adults. As a result, sorting through the offerings to find the primo stuff is a chore. Where do you begin? You could literally fill a large house with all the licensed product, which is what longtime Star Wars historian and collector Stephen J. Sansweet has done with a former chicken ranch. His refurbished barns hold all the memorabilia he accumulated when he was director of content management and head of fan relations at Lucasfilm. Welcome to Rancho Obi-Wan. Yes, that's the real name of his non-profit Star Wars museum. To store it all takes 9,000 square feet, which will need to be expanded now that Disney's merchandising mavens are working on how to add to the number of tie-in products. In Chicago, the hog capital of the world, it's said that they have found a use for every part of the pig except the squeal, and they're working on that. Well, Chicago's got nothing on Disney. No company has figured out how to market their consumer products better than the mouse. If you're interested in Star Wars-related products, here's the creme de la creme. 1. Star Wars, The Complete Saga. A boxed set of Star Wars 1 through 6 with 9 discs, 3 of which are bonus discs with supplemental material. Running time, 805 minutes. Retail cost, $139.99, but it's often discounted. Of course, in December 2017, the set became outdated because it lacks Star Wars 7, The Force Awakens, 2016, and Star Wars 8, The Last Jedi, 2017. I don't expect to see the set updated until 2018, when the Blu-ray of The Last Jedi is released, so buy this now, or buy the previous edition, which has the same content, gorgeously packaged in a hard cardboard book with a matching slipcase. Misa own that one. Star Wars 7, The Force Awakens. There are several editions available depending on where you buy it. Get any edition in Blu-ray and you'll be happy. 3. Star Wars, The Ultimate Soundtrack Collection by John Williams. As with the film sets, the music set will need to be updated because of the recent and forthcoming releases. Packaged individually in sleeves and collectively in a tray case, this collects the soundtracks to Star Wars 1 through 6. It also adds a DVD, Star Wars: A Musical Journey, and a bonus disc with interviews, John Williams and Harrison Ford, plus a fold-out contents page and 3 small color prints of movie poster photos/art on flimsy stock. 4. For authentic-looking figurines, go to SideshowToy.com. Depending on the piece, The size starts out 1/6 scale, 10.62 inches high for the Jyn Erso figurine. The premium format line offers bigger figurines, 19.5 inches. Prices for the 1/6 scale pieces of Jyn Erso cost approximately $250, with the premium format costing approximately $500. The company is also a distributor for Hot Toys Collectible Figures, which issues its own line of figurines. For the Star Wars fan who has very deep pockets and a house large enough to hold them, life-size figures are available at a correspondingly higher cost. R2-D2, $7,450. Yoda, $2,499. Boba Fett, $8,495. A Stormtrooper, $7,999.99. And my favorite, Han Solo in Carbonite, $7,499, which stands 91 inches high, roughly 7.5 feet. My recommendation? Get the R2-D2 Deluxe 1/6 scale at $149.99 or its premium format model, $379.99. C-3PO, 1/6 scale, $229.99, premium format, $399.99, or Darth Vader, 1/6 scale, $229.99, premium format, $499.99. Finally, if your family is all in with Star Wars, book yourself a room at the Star Wars-inspired themed resort at Walt Disney World Resort when they begin taking reservations. But make them early because they'll be in more demand than space heaters on the ice planet Hoth. Websites. 1. StarWars.com, the single best place for information, especially for newbies. 2. Wikipedia. The Star Wars Wiki, starwars.wikia.com, which currently has 140,395 and counting pages for your edification. 3. Disney.com, the one-stop shop for Star Wars-related, family-friendly collectibles, toys, clothing, etc. 4. DisneyWorld.disney.go.com, Orlando, Florida, for information about Disney's Hollywood Studios, where the Star Wars-themed rides and activities are located. Star Tours, the adventures continue. That will tide you over until 2019, when Star Wars Land opens. 5. Disneyland.disney.go.com, Anaheim, California, for information about Star Tours, the adventures continue, and other Star Wars-related activities. 6. StarWarsCelebration.com, for the Star Wars geek in you, this annual convention is where Wookiees hobnob with droids, where smugglers snuggle with Princess Leia's, and you'll find the droids and much more that you're looking for. Bring lots of cash and plastic money because you're gonna need them. List of operational terms. FM 101-5-1, October 1985. The working vocabulary of the U.S. military can be found in FM 101-5-1, Operational Terms and Symbols. I've handpicked terms that I believe are useful to lay readers of my study on the military science of Star Wars. Those wishing more detail should, of course, consult the field manual. For the list of operational terms that I've chosen, please consult the PDF included with this audiobook. Weapons and robots from Star Wars are making their way into real life. A Hong Kong company recently made an ultra-powerful handheld laser that looks like a lightsaber. Walking robots resembling the giant AT-ATs that Imperial forces use to attack rebels are being developed for the military to carry equipment where conventional vehicles can't go. The U.S. Army's Future Soldier Initiative went so far as to draft plans for armor that looked much like what Imperial stormtroopers wore. This means, if all goes well, a future influenced by Star Wars could go on to save millions of lives. May the Force be with it. Charles Q. Choi, How Star Wars Changed the World, space.com. This is Robert Petkoff. We hope you've enjoyed The Military Science of Star Wars by George Beam, a Macmillan audio production from Tor Books. This program was produced by Matty Argyropoulos, executive producer Laura Wilson, post-production by Danny Meltzer, recorded at the Media Staff Studio, Los Angeles. Text copyright 2018 by George Beam. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Hi, I'm Matty Argyropoulos, the producer of The Military Science of Star Wars, and I'm here with George Beam, the author.
I'm happy to be here.
In your personal experience in the Army, did you have a moment where you thought this is just like that scene in Star Wars? Or conversely, while you give parallels throughout your book between moments in the Star Wars series and military tactics and training, was there a particular scene or moment in the battle on screen that mirrored your own personal experience in the service?
Well, obviously, given the many years I've spent in the service, on extended active duty in the National Guard, and also in the Army Reserve, the Star Wars movies resonate in multiple ways, big and small. One experience, however, comes immediately to mind. I was at an Air Force base in the Southwest, home to an active duty F-16 fighter wing. We were having bad weather off and on for several days, which grounded the fighters. But the weather finally cleared up, and the air base came alive with activity. We had a briefing for a tactical training mission, a bomb run, long before the sun came up. Simultaneously, the air crews were out taking care of the maintenance issues, and by late morning, we were in the life support room where our helmets and uniforms were stored in lockers. We suited up and headed out to the flight line. We passed rows of F-16s with their engines on, with red lights flashing, and climbed into our respective jets, taxied down the runway, and lifted off in two-ship configurations, that is, two fighter aircraft, and rapidly climbed to our service ceiling of 50,000 feet, headed to our target area for a bomb run. That experience reminded me of the Battle of Yavin in the first Star Wars movie when the pilots in their X and Y-wing fighters took off from their remote rebel base to head into outer space to attack the Death Star. I had to restrain myself when I was in the life support room from telling the pilots, "May the Force be with you."
There are plenty of other movies or television shows that are centered around combat and military tactics. Why did you choose Star Wars to apply your military expertise to?
Because it's Star Wars and Star Trek that would be the ones most people would be familiar with. So it makes sense to discuss the operational arts in the context of something everyone's seen on the big or small screen. Of the two, Star Wars was easier because there's less ground to cover. Star Trek, on the other hand, covers a lot more ground. As Cliff Gillies on the website Quora explained, it would take about 23 days straight, 556 hours, to watch all of the television episodes and movies in the entire Star Trek franchise. In contrast, I limited my discussion to Star Wars to the original six movies that essentially covers Darth Vader's story and a standalone movie, Rogue One.
What do you want the listener to take from listening to your audiobook?
An appreciation and understanding of what the U.S. military is all about. Approximately 1% of our population has served in the military, so for most people, it's a world apart from the civilian world. Life on a military installation, a naval or air force base, or an army fort is self-contained and self-sufficient, and that's even more true today because of 9-1-1. For most people, what they know about the military is largely confined to what they see on television and in the movies. But unfortunately, unless it's a documentary, Hollywood isn't necessarily interested in fidelity. They're interested in filling and spilling seats in a theater. For the most part, I prefer war movies that are realistic. For instance, when I saw director Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, I thought it captured so much of what war is all about, long intervals of boredom punctuated by moments of terror. It reminds me of a conversation the late Kurt Vonnegut, who survived and chronicled the needless bombing of Dresden in World War II, recalled in an introduction to his classic war novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. In his intro, Vonnegut was telling the wife of a friend that he was writing a war book. Here's what I recall without the benefit of having the book on hand. He explained that suddenly the atmosphere became frosty and his friend's wife explained that she hated books about war that glamorized it because it made young men want to sign up and they'd come back wounded or in body bags. Vonnegut explained that that wasn't the kind of book he was going to write. Instead, he was writing an anti-war book, and after his wife's friend heard that, she felt much better. In other words, there's a big difference between war, as we usually see it, as interpreted through the lens of Hollywood, and the way it really is. Though some film directors, notably Tom Hanks, are careful to make that important distinction, which results in memorable and poignant films like Saving Private Ryan. In conclusion, I think that if the general public, most of whom have never put on a military uniform, enjoy Star Wars, they are exposed to a world of the military in an entertaining way because they may not otherwise have any exposure to what the military world is all about. The Star Wars franchise has reached countless millions of people around the world since 1977, and in doing so does its part in showing us a profession that, over time, has been denigrated and also celebrated. It's very personal to me because when I was in Army ROTC at the College of William and Mary, the Vietnam War was raging, and I fully expected to go to Vietnam in a combat role. As it turned out, the Army decided to put me in the field artillery, and that meant I would have been a forward observer calling in artillery fire. It also meant that my life expectancy would have been counted in minutes. The joke, as it were, was that the life expectancy of a forward observer in Vietnam was 3 minutes. You see, because of the devastating firepower of the field artillery, a forward observer is a prime target for snipers.
You discuss that Star Wars has shifted towards a more serious tone. What direction would you personally like to see the Star Wars movie shift towards?
Well, overall, I'd prefer to see the franchise take a grittier, more realistic tone. I absolutely loathe it when movies decide to pander to merchandising concerns, which to my mind is why we see child-friendly creatures like Ewoks and Jar Jar Binks populate the Star Wars universe. I'm especially offended when I see wholly unrealistic battle scenes, such as the one in The Return of the Jedi, in which small, teddy bear-like creatures called Ewoks, armed with spears, knives, ropes, and booby traps, manage to miraculously prevail against a garrison of crack stormtroopers, which stretches credulity to the breaking point. I mean, come on, we see a major battle erupt and only one Ewok dies? If George R.R. Martin of Game of Thrones fame had written the script, there would have been massive Ewok casualties. That's the reality of the situation. Instead, what we get is a sanitized cartoon, which is deeply insulting because it is dishonest. It fundamentally misrepresents the nature of combat.
If you were to build your own squad from characters in the Star Wars universe, who would you want on your team, and what would their rankings be?
An interesting question. Assuming I had to pick subordinate personnel, I'd want a composite of personnel that included seasoned officers and NCOs. The latter is especially important because, as anyone in the military knows, the NCOs, non-commissioned officers or non-coms, are the backbone of the military. My father, who retired in the Air Force after 27 years with the rank of E-8, Senior Master Sergeant, took me aside immediately after he pinned me with second lieutenant bars at the ROTC commissioning ceremony upon college graduation. And he told me, "Son, always listen to your NCOs. They've got years of experience. You're a buddy butter bar. You have a lot to learn." He was right. I learned a lot from my NCOs, and I always heeded their advice. They knew whereof they spoke. Now, to directly answer the question, as a captain commanding a company or a battery, approximately 100 men, I'd want a technically and tactically proficient first lieutenant who could think on his feet. I'd want a team player and someone who could give and receive orders with equal aplomb. I'd want someone whom I felt could step in my combat boots if I bought the farm. I'd want someone whom the others would look up to. I'd want someone who'd tell me frankly what was on his mind. Someone in his early to mid-20s. In short, I'd want a young Han Solo. That Han Solo ultimately assumed the rank of general, presumably one star, with the rebel forces speaks well of his leadership skills. If I were under his command, I'd not hesitate to willingly follow him into combat. That's the barometer by which I measure commanders at every echelon. I'd also want a smart, quick-acting second lieutenant, someone young and flexible in his thinking. I'd want someone who sought out the advice of his subordinate NCOs. I'd want someone in his early 20s. I'd especially want someone who exhibited initiative, and if the XO or I bought the farm, that is, got killed, he or she wouldn't hesitate to step up and take command. In short, I'd want Jyn Erso. For NCOs, I'd want steadfast, reliable personnel with years of experience. I'd want someone who wouldn't hesitate to speak his mind. I'd want someone the junior NCOs would look up to. The rank would be at least an E6, staff sergeant. I'd want someone who has my back and knew how to take care of himself in a combat situation. I'd want Chewbacca. In the enlisted ranks, there's lots of choices within the Star Wars ranks, but if I needed a heavy weapons guy, I'd want Baze Malbus from Rogue One. He's big enough to carry a heavy repeater cannon, which can lay down a lot of firepower. He's courageous, and he's got the back of anyone he's protecting, notably the blind man named Chirrut. In short, Malbus is a badass, and that's what you want when you're under attack. You want him to target the enemy, start firing, and mow him down. You want him to ruin their entire day. When I say you want him to ruin their entire day, that's a military expression. What it means, for instance, is, well, we're going to pop this nuclear weapon on the enemy, and it's going to ruin his whole day.
Can you elaborate on the process of writing the book? What was the research like? What obstacles did you come up against? What section was the easiest and most fun to write?
So many questions. Well, I'm not sure most listeners will want a blow-by-blow description of the book writing and publishing process, but since at least one inquiring mind wants to know, here's a crash course. First, I've written dozens of books, so I've got the process formalized. Writing a book is a matter of coming up with an idea, testing the idea, doing a lot of research, breaking everything down in chapters, and then start writing. Fortunately, with this book, it was a lot of fun because I got to watch all the Star Wars movies multiple times, and for background music, I got to listen to the soundtracks. The research is the most time-consuming part, but I enjoy it. My concern always is that I'm going to get something wrong because readers are quick to point out an author's mistakes. But mostly, it's a lot of reading and synthesizing before I begin writing. The only obstacle, as it were, is the deadline. That's when the publisher wants the book submitted for editing. I usually work backward in that regard. I see what time I have, and then backtrack all the necessary steps so I have a workable plan built on a realistic timetable. As to what section was the easiest to write, the profiles on the major characters were easy because I'm so familiar with them. Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, Leia Organa, et al. It's like they're old friends, so that required no research to speak of. The tactical discussions took a lot of research. Given more time and space, I could have expanded each battle into its own book-length study, but that's beyond the scope of this book.
And now we've come to the quick-fire questions.
Fire away.
Galactic Empire or Rebel Alliance?
The Rebel Alliance, because, as Steve Jobs famously said, it's better to be a pirate than join the Navy. Besides, I've always been a rebel with a cause.
Favorite Star Wars movie?
My favorite is the first one that was released on May 25th, 1977. Fans today know it as Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. I'll always remember it by its original title because I saw it in the theater back in the day. I count myself fortunate that 8 months before the movie came out, I got a sneak peek of it at the World Science Fiction Convention in Kansas City. There were movie props and uniforms on display, and Mark Hamill was on a panel to talk up the movie. Interestingly, when he fielded questions from the audience, one of the fans commented about how unrealistic it was that with all the blaster rifles being fired by stormtroopers, Hamill never got hit, not even once. He explained that Lucas said, "It's just not that kind of movie. It's a fairy tale. It's sweet, it's a swashbuckler, it's a cliche, but that sort of sums it up." In other words, it's a space opera, a romantic fantasy in the traditional sense of the word, but not necessarily realistic.
Favorite droid?
Most people will cite R2-D2 and C-3PO, but R2-D2 is a tad too cute for me, and C-3PO a tad too fussy, like a British butler. My choice would certainly be K-250 from Rogue One. He was an Imperial droid that was reprogrammed by a rebel named Cassian Andor. The result was a very atypical character. K-250 has very human responses, along with a dry wit. He's also, as we've learned, a hero who sacrifices himself for the mission. He's the droid I'd be looking for.
Favorite line?
In Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, General Hux witnesses an awesome display of firepower from several all-terrain armored transports called AT-ATs, supplemented by firepower from TIE fighters. The collective firepower is aimed at Luke Skywalker, who stands alone in a barren area in front of a blast door protecting what's left of the Resistance forces. On the order of Kylo Ren, who has now taken command after killing Supreme Leader Snoke of the First Order, they unleash a devastating attack on Luke Skywalker. When Kylo Ren orders the firing to stop, General Hux wryly comments, "Do you think you got him?" The officers of the First Order, as a general rule, tend to be cardboard characters with no sense of humor. Case in point, Captain Phasma. But Hux's rhetorical question made me laugh. It put everything in the proper perspective. Let's be honest, one of the weaknesses of Star Wars as a whole is that the characters tend to be either good or bad, which fosters stereotypes. But, as Game of Thrones writer George R.R. Martin points out, people are much more complicated. They are forever at war with themselves. They have good points and bad points, and thus are more interesting as characters. I like that complexity in people when portrayed in movies. Otherwise, what you have are cartoon characters.
Who shot first?
No doubt, Han Solo. Case closed.
Favorite military weapon?
Most Star Wars fans will point to the lightsaber, which is an elegant and sexy weapon. But, as I point out in this book, it's a weapon of very limited use. It's good for close-in fighting only. It's basically an energized light sword. Interestingly, the weapons technology currently in the works draws in part from movies like Star Wars, in which imaginative designers envision what weapons of the future will look like. All of them, of course, follow the classic thesis-antithesis model. That is to say, if you invent an airplane, the enemy will invent an anti-aircraft missile. In short, weapons technology is constantly evolving because it must. A good example, and my favorite military weapon in terms of hardware, is a droideka, or destroyer droids, capable of transforming itself into a ball that moves up to 75 kilometers an hour. It's armed with two blaster cannons and protected by a deflector shield generator. Once it stops, it can immediately transform into a weapons platform in seconds and lay down withering fire. This kind of weapon will, in time, be standard issue for any U.S. infantry unit or Marine Expeditionary Force. My favorite military software is the human brain. No doubt, artificial intelligence will be an important component of military weapons technology in the future, but as the Air Force's Predator drone has shown us, we still need the human factor, because, after all, any force-on-force conflict will be humans battling their own kind, supplemented by robotic warriors resembling battle droids. Inexpensive, mass-produced, and expendable assets that, for the record, was originally envisioned by a popular cartoonist from the 60s, the late Von Baudet, who envisioned an all-robotic military conflict as humans hunkered down underground for protection.
Favorite battle and why? And it doesn't have to be Star Wars related.
When I see any military movie, I always do a postmortem and discuss its military aspects with my long-suffering wife, who in truth has little patience and no interest in hearing me talk about it. I'd have a more sympathetic audience if I paid attention to an old army saying, "If the army wanted you to have a wife, they would have issued you one." Presumably, an army-issued wife would be more accommodating. That said, my favorite battle is from The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. It's the Battle of Hornburg, known as the Battle of Helm's Deep. and it's a perfect example of a ground assault against a fixed installation. It pits King Theoden's numerically inferior force in a massive fort against Saruman's composite force, who have the tactical advantage by being on the offensive. Moreover, many of Theoden's troops, as one of his captains observed, are not ideally suited for combat. Quote, "The soldiers have either seen too many winners or too few." In contrast, Saruman's troops are well-armed, well-trained, and synchronized in a well-planned offensive operation that would strike fear in any defender's heart. As we watch Saruman's forces attack, we see Theoden and his forces, who can only react to the attack. It's a set piece in how to conduct a ground assault, and if I were commanding Saruman's forces, I would not have changed a thing tactically, except, of course, to guard against a large force of unexpected cavalry, which saves the day for Theoden. In other words, if left to his own devices, Theoden's Helm's Deep would have fallen, with a resultant catastrophic loss of life.
Thank you so much, George, for that illuminating interview.
And you're more than welcome. This is so much fun.
May the Force be with you.
And may the Force be with you always.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.